Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Robert Glenn, who is our Vice President for Student Affairs and Vice Provost for Enrollment Management, is departing these hallowed halls to go home, in a sense, despite what Thomas Wolfe said. He will be the next president of Athens State University in Athens, Alabama, which is in northern Alabama in Limestone County. We're going to miss Dr. Glenn, and so we're going to bid him a fond farewell by giving him a last opportunity to say whatever is on his mind, give him an exit interview. At any rate, Dr. Glenn, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I looked up online a copy of The Record, the administration newspaper of MTSU, and the story in which it was written up that you had just been named the new vice president for student affairs. And in that same edition of The Record were stories about Gloria Bonner being named the dean of education and behavioral science, and Marvin Runyon being named the chair in manufacturing excellence. Does it seem like that long ago?
Well, gosh, it does seem like just yesterday. Now Gloria's gone on to the position she's in community affairs, and of course, Marvin's gone on to even greater rewards, but it seems like just a blink of an eye. I know it's been 9 years, but it's just passed so quickly.
Tell me what you think your greatest accomplishment is, the thing that you're the most proud of in your time here.
Well, I think any good administrator is a catalyst. He doesn't necessarily do things, but he sparks happenings on the campus. And I feel fortunate in that I have been able to spark some things, or at least feel like I've been able to spark some things that have been very positive for the campus. When I first came here, for instance, you could walk across the campus and just not see any student wearing Raider blue or sporting anything that said MT on it. And we worked very deliberately and very hard at reinstilling, sparking, if you will, that sense of school spirit in our students. And I've been very pleased to see that it's beginning to take real strong root on our campus.
How does an administrator do that through the bureaucracy when it's really a heartfelt, from the ground up, bottom up kind of feeling?
Well, I think part of it is in establishing, if you will, the feel of the place as people come in, setting the plate, if you will, setting the table when someone's about to sit down for dinner. One of the things that we did is we started saying to students as they came to customs, you're one of us now. You're a Blue Raider, and you should be proud of that. You should be pleased. This is a great school. This is not an also-ran institution. This is a destination institution. We have more valedictorians and salutatorians than anyone else. We have more nationally ranked programs, more regionally ranked programs. There's no reason for you to hold your head down. It's fine if you want to be a UT fan or a Mandy fan or some fan of some other institution, but you should also be a Blue Raider fan while you're here. Because if you came here for 4 years and spent your entire time rooting for UT, that's a little bit like going out on a date and talking about all evening the person you wish you were with. It's just not a very good strategy.
But it's got to take a little out-of-the-box creative thinking, because school spirit is the one thing that the university cannot enforce. The university can make a rule saying you have to pay your tuition and enforce it. The university can make a rule saying no alcohol on campus and enforce it. You can't impose or enforce school spirit on someone. They have to feel it.
That's very true, and that's why I say, as an administrator, you've got to be a catalyst, because you're absolutely right. You can't make people be proud. But what you can do is you can act proud yourself. You can show enthusiasm yourself. You can create an environment of excitement. So we started doing things like the pep rallies on campus. We created the week of welcome activities that when students first come here, we have 2 weeks worth of activities that kind of set the stage for being a part of our community. We started working very deliberately on tailgating activities so that game day would be more than just going to the stadium. It would be a day of activities. It'd be something you could look forward to, and it wouldn't necessarily be dependent on a winning record, because as you recall, we've had one or two seasons where we didn't. But we were still able to create an environment that people enjoyed coming out and being a part of what was going on. My first year here, I think the largest student turnout we had at a football game was 1,500 students. And by the end of the season, it had dwindled. But we were averaging between 5,000 and 7,000 students at every home game this year. So I feel like we're turning the corner and we're beginning to give people that feel of a real traditional kind of campus.
Of course, school spirit isn't totally about athletics. What about academic school pride?
Well, you know, I would point to the opening of school convocation that we instituted. We started the summer reading program. We talked to students about the fact that they are coming here to begin to learn how to take an idea in their head and turn it about and look at it from all angles and come to a point of view. So that was the point of the summer reading exercise, for them to, all of them at the same time, look at one idea, one set of propositions, and then to attend the opening of school convocation where we had the faculty march in regalia, and we talked about what a big deal it is for the faculty to be there in regalia and how that's an honor to them as incoming students. And again, they're now one of us. You're leaving high school behind, you're coming to college, you're a part of the community of scholars, you have new responsibilities here. One of them is to be a participant in your education, not just a passive spectator. You need to read, you need to think, you need to argue, you need to assert. All of that is a part of it. And by picking the book and then persuading faculty to use it in different kinds of classes so that students would have an opportunity to consider what they believed, and hearing the author speak at the convocation, you know, we think that that was a part of that school spirit, but it wasn't all pep rally and cheers.
Speaking about participation and arguing to the extent that that is a part of it, some people have commented and lamented on what they perceive to be a sort of ennui or lack of activism, political activism, especially on college campuses, unlike the 60s, the heyday of political college activism, some of which was violent, some of which was nonviolent. But school organizations, the student organizations on this campus, both Greek and non-Greek, are engaged in a great deal of activism, mostly charitable work, that a lot of people don't know about and don't hear about, it seems to me.
I would absolutely agree, and I would suggest anyone that would say that our students are passive is that they're just not paying attention. You make a very good point, for instance, in terms of community service and contribution to the greater society. You know, I would point out that in the last 9 years, we've established a very strong program called Up Till Dawn, which each year raises money for St. Jude's Research Hospital. We're now raising in excess of $100,000 a year for that program. That's our students raising that amount of money. This past year, they built a house. Our students built a house by themselves. They raised the money, the $50,000 that was required to buy the materials, and then they provided the labor to build a Habitat House for Humanity. And you look at groups like AOPI that does its smoke arthritis barbecue every year, raises between $15,000 and $20,000 a year for arthritis research. You look at the Student Government Association, which has had some very lively debates on a variety of topics. I remember about a year ago that we had a group of students that were concerned about the presence of Nathan Bedford Forrest's name on one of our buildings, and that led to a very active time on our campus of comment and conversation and debate. So if anybody thinks our students aren't being participants and aren't active, they really aren't paying attention. I would also point out that we're about to crank up for another presidential election, and I suspect that next fall you will see a very active campus as people advocate for their points of views and their candidates.
We not only do we have the College Democrats and the Raider Republicans, but we have organizations as diverse as the newly formed or reformed Students for a Democratic Society. We have students that student organizations that advocate for separation of church and state. There are all kinds of ideas being espoused through student organizations here at MTSU, and to the best of my knowledge, no attempt whatsoever on the part of the administration to try to repress things, because what's a university for if not freedom of thought?
That's exactly right. A lot of times people will be a little cranky with us because we make them follow the rules for their expression.
But the rules are uniformly enforced.
But the rules are enforced for everybody that walks down the road. It's always been interesting to me. My observation is that nobody truly likes the First Amendment, particularly when it requires allowing a viewpoint they disagree with strongly to be expressed. So when we've had conservative groups such as the Genocide Awareness Project, which is an anti-abortion group, when they were on campus and we allowed them to express themselves, we got lots of complaints from people who thought that was inappropriate and they shouldn't be allowed to express their views. When we had the pornography debate that occurred about 2 or 3 years ago, we had lots of conservatives who were angry because points of views they disagreed with were being aired. So it's always a difficult time. We've had some anti-war demonstrations, and you know, whatever the issue is, if it's an issue that's controversial, then the university is going to take criticism from the opposing point of view for allowing that to be expressed. But you're absolutely right. A college campus is exactly where that should be talked about. It's exactly where people ought to have an opportunity to stand up, even if it's a controversial point of view, to express it, and for someone else to stand up and challenge that idea. I mean, that's the whole point of the marketplace of ideas, and that it's the clash between ideas that generates the energy to exalt the best ideas and bring down the bad ideas. And the presence of controversial ideas doesn't do anything but add energy to the conversation, which, again, lifts the best ideas up. So when people start talking about limiting what can be in the marketplace of ideas, you know, that's just crazy. Now, you know, America has always had that conversation ongoing. I think it was John F. Kennedy who said that a government that is afraid of allowing its citizens to discern good and bad ideas in the marketplace of ideas is not afraid of ideas, it's afraid of its people. And we're fortunate that we live in a country that's not afraid of its people, and it's a great privilege to be on a campus where those debatable viewpoints can be fully examined and fully debated, argued, groused, whatever you want to call it. But it generates great energy, and it's a real joy to watch.
Well, moving on to another student issue, where do you think we've come with housing on campus in 9 years?
In 9 years, I believe very strongly that we're making good strides. Sarah Sudak, who is the Executive Director of Housing, and Deb Sales, who's the Associate Vice Provost for Academic Support Services, are, in my opinion, doing an exceptional job. As you know, we're in the midst of a 12-year, $70 million renovation plan. We're about 6 years into the plan. And if you go into, say, Monahan, which was one that was recently renovated, if you've ever seen it before and you go in there now, it's just the difference is like night and day. And they're doing such a great job of creating living spaces that are truly welcoming and truly enjoyable to live in, as opposed to places that were simply a place to exist.
Brick and mortar repositories that look like Section 8 housing.
Exactly.
Yes. I found my dormitory room in the 70s at the University of Tennessee particularly depressing, but that's neither here nor there.
I understand.
With regard to public safety, an issue which became even more heightened, perhaps, beyond all reason in some cases, after the tragedy at Virginia Tech. Where have we come in 9 years?
Well, I think the first thing I would want to say to people on the issue of safety on campus is that we remain a remarkably safe institution, and higher education campuses remain remarkably safe. If you actually look at the statistics, the murder rate, for instance, off campus compared to on campus, you are somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 times more likely to be the victim of a violent assault or to be killed off campus than you are on campus. If you look at the actual numbers of violent crimes involving college students, 93% of them occur off campus, not on campus. While there have been very violent episodes at Virginia Tech and Northern Illinois, people should not assume that there is lurking danger on every college campus. There is not. Now, we have had an opportunity to put into place programs that I think enhance what is already a safe environment. The text messaging system that we have in place allows us to communicate very quickly with the students who are registered. So if there's a tornado or a gunman or someone who is poses a threat to our students, we can communicate with them instantly. The only thing that we haven't been able to do in that regard is figure out how to compel our students to sign up for it, because only about a quarter of our students, only about 6,000 out of 23,000, have signed up for it. But I think we will improve on that as time goes along.
And improve on the system, because that's still a work in progress very
Absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely. Technology is just developing so rapidly. I don't think it will be very long at all before you'll see, for instance, visual displays across campus that are linked so that if there was a need to get out a warning, that in addition to the text messages, you'd have the visual warnings. I'm sure that we will find very shortly ways to incorporate the sirens with the tornado sirens that we have on campus to create new sounds that will be distinctive, that can alert people, that we can use the audio that's part of the tower to speak to our campus. The technology is just moving so rapidly. It's going to be really interesting to watch.
I know that the national economy doesn't come under your purview as VP of Student Affairs, but I'm sure you've heard more than your share of complaints about fees and tuition over the past
certainly.
9 years. They go up every year, and I'm sure a lot of those complaints from parents and students come to your office.
And rightfully so, because they should be able to express their concerns. One of the things I try to remind people all the time is that the actual cost to students is a result not only of the increase in costs generally, but also it's a reflection of the support of the state of Tennessee, and that support is declining. It's not increasing. 30 years ago, the idea was that the state had an interest in developing an educated citizenry, and so it was a valuable investment to put money into education and into higher education. And the cost was divided accordingly. The state paid about 70% of the cost of a higher education degree.
For an in-state student.
For an in-state student. But now the burden is very definitely shifting. It's now 60-40 with the student picking up 60% of the cost. And there's an increasing demand when you read the paper, when you read the comments in the blogs and on the websites, that the people who are benefiting from the education should be the ones to bear the full cost. And I'm not going to argue the relative merits of that, but I will point out that when we get to that point, that that's going to create a definite barrier to the education of people who come from economically disadvantaged circumstances. And I think it would be an unfortunate road for us to go down. But, you know, the reality is in 2003, when Governor Bredesen was in his first year, our base allocation from the state was $111 million. Next fall, after the state has once again reduced our budget, this year by some $6.1 million, our base budget will be $94 million. Now, that's a $17 million reduction in a five-year time span.
Even as inflation has gone up.
Coupled with inflation and coupled with an increase in enrollment. We've increased somewhere in the neighborhood of between 2,000 and 3,000 students during that five-year time span. So there's a higher demand, a higher cost of doing business, and less state dollars. So how anyone could think that that would not translate into increased tuition and fees. I think they're just being way more optimistic than they have any right to be.
And this isn't about MTSU because it's happening all over, but at any institution you want to pick. But the parent who sets aside that college trust fund for that baby when that baby is born and makes calculations based on estimated income, not taking into account, you know, catastrophes that can happen unexpectedly in life, so forth and so on, finds at the end of 18 years that they still don't have enough to really put that kid through school, and this seems to be a trend. Can you offer those parents any hope?
The main hope that I can offer them, of course, is to continue to be proactive and take matters into their hands as much as they can. When you look, for instance, at the lottery scholarship program that exists in this state, that should help students. The lottery program does not help the university that much. A lot of people, I think that it's a real boon to the university. It really isn't. But it is a boon to our students because the $4,000 you get cuts in half or nearly in half the cost of attendance at our institution, which for a commuting student is somewhere around $13,000, for a residential student somewhere around $10,000. So you can see it really provides the incentive, and if you've got that nest egg that you've been setting, combine it with the lottery, you can do pretty well. The loan, the debt load will be lowered significantly. And there again, it's up to the student to do the work to maintain the GPA in order to keep that scholarship. I know there was a lot of conversation recently about the lowering of the retention rate to 275, and a lot of people call that dumbing down the lottery. And I would have to disagree rather vigorously, because if you look at the statistics, if you look at our graduation rates over the last 20 years, what you will see is that we are already skewed positively. If you look at that bell curve, it's already positively skewed towards the upper end. What the purpose of the lottery is not to get people to make certain grades. The purpose of the lottery is to give people an incentive that will allow them to go to college and then help them stay there. So you don't dumb down the lottery by lowering the retention rate. What you're doing is you're simply increasing a larger proportion of the curve to ensure that students stay in school, which is important because if you look at the research, there's absolutely no research that demonstrates that a person who graduates with a 275 has any less earning capacity as a productive citizen than the person with the 3-point. There is no research that indicates there's any significant difference. So keeping that 2.75 students in school to where they get a degree, that's what will make the difference, because there's lots of research that shows those without degrees earn less over their lifetime than those with degrees. So the people who say that it's dumbing it down just don't get the point.
Right. You are going from a vice president's position to a president's position, president of a school with it's a state-supported institution with a smaller enrollment. A VP has a great deal of power on a college campus, but as president, you'll be calling the shots. How would you describe what sort of a management style you're going to take into this new position?
Well, I feel like, and I hope that I have learned a great deal from the presidents that I have served over the years, and I've served with some very good ones. I would certainly rate Dr. McPhee as a good one. I've served with some very bad ones, and I won't name them. and I think you learn just as much from the bad managers as you do from the very good. So I think what I will be taking with me is a belief that as president, just because I'm president doesn't mean the institution will go anywhere. It will go somewhere only if I'm able to convince people to go where we ought to go. So creating consensus, being open in communication, being receptive and welcoming to people, these are all things that I think are very important. At the same time, that doesn't mean I'm going to be wishy-washy. I think one of the things a great leader does is to perceive the consensus and take that consensus and turn it into a vision that's ruthlessly communicated and used to engage people and bring them along so that you get the institution all going in the same direction.
Would you describe yourself as a micromanager, a macro manager, or somewhere in between?
I would describe myself as a get-out-of-the-way manager.
Follower, get-out-of-the-way manager?
No, I would say I'm the kind of guy who says, North is that way. Here's what I want you to do, and here is my expectations, and here's what will happen if you don't do it, and here's what will happen if you do it. Now go and do.
Okay.
If you get the very best people, that's all you need to do.
Now, after you give them the guidance and the directions and the directive, then do you give them the autonomy to get it done their way?
That's what I mean by being a get-out-of-the-way leader. If you get the right people, they will enjoy doing their job, and they will be eager to have a chance to do it and show you how good they are. So if you give them the directive and you give them the autonomy and you get out of their way, then you can see great things happen.
Do you consider it part of your responsibility to inspire or motivate people?
Certainly. I think part of what a leader is supposed to do is to, if you will, set the table for us to all come sit down and do good things together. And part of that is having the vision, communicating the vision, exhorting people, extolling them, getting them to go the extra mile.
How does that balance out with needing to hire and needing to retain people who are self-motivated and self-directed?
Well, I think one of the things you do is you get people who want to sit in your chair, and you empower them to do the very best job that they can, knowing that you're going to lose them somewhere along the way. But if you've got people who want to be in your chair, then they've hired people who want to be in that chair. And so the process should just be not perpetual, but pretty close.
So you can't afford to be paranoid of your rivals then?
No, you can't afford to worry about that sort of thing. You've got to empower people and let them loose.
Okay. Is this where you intend to retire when you finally hang up the mortarboard and say, I'm going to go fishing?
I don't know. I would say this is a place that has a lot of work to be done, and I'm very excited about doing it, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens along the way. But my old daddy said you never close any door you don't have to.
Okay. Well, you do have a lot of family history. You could briefly explain that.
Sure.
In regard to Athens State.
My great-grandfather was the president of Athens State in 1902, from 1902 to 1904. That's when it was a Methodist institution. My great-grandfather was a Methodist circuit riding minister and a part of the North Alabama Conference. He was actually president of two colleges. The other one was North Alabama Conference College, which became Birmingham College, which became Birmingham Southern. So there's a long history in our family of being engaged in education and being engaged in the Methodist Church.
And you'll be the second Glenn to take over the reins?
That's exactly right.
How much did the family connection play in helping you?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess you'd have to ask the chancellor of the community college system, who's the fellow who hired me. I think that it was one of those things that people thought was neat. They thought it was really interesting. How much it played in terms of their perception, I really don't know. But everybody there at the institution has been really interested in that and has asked me about that. And I've gone, they all wanted me to see the picture that was painted of my great-grandfather that's hanging in the library. And, the archivist wanted to talk to me about what they have on file. So it's been kind of fun.
Well, you have been an interesting chapter in the history of this institution, and you'll be an interesting and important chapter in the history of Athens State as well. Bob, go with God.
Thank you very much. I look forward to the challenges.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we invite you to join us again at the same time next Sunday. Check us out at mtsunews.com and download the podcast. And don't forget, we are also on iTunes.